right, good morning, everybody. Today is Wednesday, I think, June 2nd, 2015. It's Tuesday. Oh, thank goodness it's Tuesday. God, I thought it was Wednesday. Tuesday, June 2nd, 2015. And this says, before the first cup of jewels here on UCY.TV, happy Tuesday. Wow, I thought it was Wednesday. And I'm like, man, this week flew by and I'm out of time and I got so much to do. It is 52 degrees and soggy here in upstate New York. And to be honest, it feels even chillier than 52. And it's kind of funny because I went out and took a look at my old school thermometer that's sitting out back. And that actually says 38. But hey, the Weather Channel says it's 52. So hope everyone's doing great this Tuesday. We're going to continue today where we left off. We were looking at a bunch of different things. Titled the show yesterday, Technocracy, Freedom's Death, and Bill Gates. And we listened at the end of the show yesterday to an interview with Bill Gates talking about what keeps him up at night and what he believes is going to be the end of planet Earth. If you want, actually, that might be, I don't know, Bill Gates always is good for nightmares. I don't know if we want to listen to that one again. I think we should. I think we should kick off the show for all of you who missed it. And let's check out what Billy Gates has to say about what keeps him up at night and what he predicts is going to be the biggest disaster of all humankind. And like I said yesterday, I could guarantee that all of you, If I put a Cupid doll to it, all of you would be able to guess what Bill Gates' biggest nightmare was. All right, here, hold on 1 second. Let me connect up, and we'll listen to this, and then we will continue from where we left off yesterday. There's actually quite a few updates I want to get to. All right, let's see if this is going to play. What is Billy Gates afraid of? Oh, the demons under his bed, and we don't need this commercial, though. All right, 2, 1, boop. Here we go.
Describe for me as vividly as you can what it is you're worried about, what it is that nightmare scenario looks like.
Unfortunately, there's very few things, and most of them are very low probability. Some big volcanic explosion, gigantic earthquake, asteroid. Well, at least in the nuclear case, you've got to say we take it quite seriously. We budget a lot of money, have a lot of people who think about nuclear deterrence, and I'm very glad that work's being done, and I rate the chance of a nuclear war in my lifetime as being fairly low. I rate the chance of a widespread epidemic far worse than Ebola in my lifetime is well over 50%.
Beep, 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 beep. Right? Far worse than Ebola, greater than 50%. And this is one of the reasons why when I've been looking at some of this stuff, I'm like, put on a seatbelt, people, because Bill Gates, who is very well invested in the vaccination machine, good old Billy Gates is predicting over 50% he's going to see a massive global epidemic in his lifetime.
If we look at the 20th century and we look at the death chart of the 20th century, I think everybody would say, oh yeah, there must be a spike for World War I. You know, sure enough, there it is, like 25 million. And there must be a big spike for World War II, and there it is, it's like 65 million. But then you'll see this other spike that is as large as World War II right after World War I. And most people, a lot of people would say, well, what? What was that? There's two kinds of flus. There's flus that spread between humans very effectively, and there's flus that kill lots of people. And those two properties have only been combined into a widespread flu once in history. Well, that is Spanish flu. We have no idea where it came from.
Beep, beep, beep.
The Spanish flu, because the Spanish press was the freest. They were the first to talk openly about it.
I want to stop for a second because at this point yesterday, I had postulated, you know, he said, like, if we look at this global death chart, we had World War I, there was a spike. We had World War II, there was a spike. And then there was a spike in between the two wars. And that happened to be the flu outbreak of 1918, I believe, right? Is that when it was? Yeah, it was 1918. Of the Spanish flu that killed millions of people. And hold on, I got to kill I hate when that echoes. And, you know, I postulated that how interesting that it was right after a world war. We have all this mad science gone mad that happens that we know about, and it's not always in the public eye. And to me, just the way they show in this next segment, the way it spread across the planet, we didn't really have airplanes. People weren't jet setting commercially back in 1918 that I'm aware of, you know. So how did it spread so quickly? And I found a couple stories that gave a bunch of different links to a lot of historical information that said very much what I said, that the Nazis had been messing around with bio terror agents, bio warfare agents in the lab during World War One. But I found something from the CDC's website, and this was something that I brought up after the segment played, is that we've reconstructed this super flu of 1918, and they made it even more virulent than it was in 1918, and then they published the results. And this was just over the last few years they did that. Let me just read this. This is from the CDC's website. Reconstruction of the 1918 influenza pandemic virus. Like, wow, what a great idea that is. CDC researchers, and especially considering when we've taken a look at over the last few shows, just how absolutely idiotic not only the CDC, but the DOD have been with these highly pathogenic materials, and this chain of command is not being followed. They're very lax. Things are being shipped out that, oh, whoops, we thought they were killed, but whoops, they were live. And I have an update, too, on those numbers. There's now 3 countries and 24 labs, I think the newest story said, that this this what they thought was killed anthrax was now shipped to. And it's growing by the minute. I mean, who knows how long they thought that they've been killing this anthrax using gamma and X-ray radiation, and it hasn't been killed, and they've been shipping it all over the planet. Sounds like a good recipe for quote-unquote ISIS to get their hands in there. But, you know, so let's listen to this about the CDC. So CDC researchers and their colleagues successfully reconstructed the influenza virus that caused the 1918 to 1919 flu pandemic, which killed as many as 50 million people. Now, wow, that sounds like a number that good old Billy Gates could be proud of. A report of their work, and then there's a link, characterization of the reconstructed 1918 Spanish influenza pandemic virus, was published in the October 7th, 2005 issue of Science, which is a magazine. The work was a collaboration among the scientists from the CDC, the Mount Sinai School of Medicine, figure that one, the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, and check this one out, the Southeast Poultry Research Laboratory. Ding, 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 poultry, bird flu. The following questions and answers describe this important research and related issues. It says, what research does Science describe, and why is it important? It says, this report describes the successful reconstruction of influenza A, which is the H1N1 virus, responsible for the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic, and provides new information about the properties that contributed to its exceptional virulence. This information is critical to evaluating the effectiveness of current and future public health interventions, and could be used in the event that a 1918-like virus reemerges. Go figure. The knowledge from this work may also shed light on the pathogenesis of contemporary human influenza viruses with pandemic potential. The natural reemergence of another pandemic virus is considered highly likely by many experts and Bill Gates, and therefore insights into pathogenic mechanisms could contribute to the development of prophylactic, and I've talked about that. They've been working on all kinds of prophylactic vaccines to give you, to keep you safe. The development of prophylactic and therapeutic interventions needed to control pandemic viruses. What are the reasons for doing these experiments, oh great CDC, they ask? Well, the influenza pandemic of 1918 to 1919 killed an estimated, 20 to 50 million people, so give or take 30 million or so, many more than the subsequent pandemics of the 20th century. The biological properties that confer virulence to pandemic influenza viruses were poorly understood back then. Research to better understand how the individual genes of the 1918 pandemic influenza virus contribute to the disease process, and they could provide important insight into the basis of virulence. This kind of information will enable us to devise appropriate strategies for early diagnosis, treatment, and prevention should a similar pandemic virus emerge. Oh, yes, out of nowhere, never before seen. We don't know where it came from. Now, notice we've seen all those words being used over and over again in the last year, especially. For all these never before seen, hasn't been seen here in 50 years. Oh my God, it's jumping from dogs to human. Never before on this continent. Very, very, very suspicious in my eyes. Especially when we know that all the rich fuckers are invested in the vaccine industry. Additionally, such research will provide us with general principles with which we can better design antiviral drugs and interventions against all influenza viruses with enhanced virulence. And yes, don't forget, DARPA has been working on a universal flu vaccination since about 2006. That was using the technology that they ended up using in one of the Ebola vaccines, which was using the genetically engineered tobacco where they drowned it in that, I don't even remember what they made the liquid out of. They sucked it out of, I don't know, some sort of recombinant cells that they put into a mouse and then sucked it out of a mouse and then made this liquid and then drowned the tobacco in it. And then the genetically modified tobacco was using some sort of RNAi in creating this vaccine. I mean, yeah, get right in line because I want to be a version 1.0 guinea pig for that shit. That original project, it was called Blue Angel Project by DARPA, and the Blue Angel Project was to develop a universal flu vaccine. So basically, it was a search and destroy mission, kind of like we've talked about for new world antivirus versus old world antivirus, where you have like a day zero attack on the computer where all it's looking for, it doesn't have to look for signatures anymore. You don't have to have an updated antivirus signature on your computer if you're running day zero software because it doesn't need specific signatures anymore. All it needs to detect is anomalous behavior. Well, this new RNAi vaccination for flu, in particular this Blue Angel Project, that's exactly the way it was going to work within the human body. It was going to look for anomalous behaviors within the immune system to determine whether or not there was a foreign invader. And that would be how, you know, right now their big argument is, well, we have to produce the flu vaccination the year before. They produce it in eggs. It takes a really long time. And a lot of times what happens is by the time the next year's flu season comes around, whoops, there have been other flu viruses that have mixed in there. And now they have to tell us, well, go get your flu vaccine, but it isn't going to be for the right viruses. But get it anyway, because it might help a little bit. So with this universal flu vaccine, the whole story was that it would be able to detect any type of flu that was entering your bloodstream and protect against that. Now, I haven't seen much on that. When I took that FEMA class, and I still don't remember if it was the end of 2006, beginning of 2007, that was one of the big things they were telling us all about, is this new universal flu vaccine. We learned all about pandemics. We learned all about what to do if anthrax hits our community and how to get everything ready and make sure we get out Cipro to our whole neighborhood. And be afraid, be very afraid. But don't worry, because the government is working on a universal flu vaccine. And that was, I didn't know it was called the Blue Angel Program, but I think back in 2011, maybe it was 2011, when I first met Madison Rupert, and I was working with him on his End the Lie stuff, that was where I first learned about it. He did a big story on the Blue Angel Program. Maybe we'll find that if I have another clip here and I have a few minutes to do a search. All right, let's read a little bit more here, because this is very interesting that this is on the CDC site. And it really bothers me that the way it starts out is the very first sentence. CDC researchers and their colleagues successfully reconstructed the influenza virus that caused the 1918 to 1919 flu pandemic, which killed as many as 50 million people worldwide. I mean, if you didn't think they were psychopaths before, maybe we should read that sentence over and over and over again and write it up on a blackboard. Because that's psychopathy right there. Why would we reconstruct that virus? Oh, but it's in the name of defense against a pandemic. Yes, unless we then take a look at what a bunch of complete nincompoops we have that run the CDC, their high security labs, and the DOD's high security lab. It's very, very frightening. They're lining it up. I can see it. They are absolutely lining this up. Who funded? Wait, I don't know if I missed it. Did I miss a paragraph? No. Who funded the work described in this article? Oh, well, wouldn't we like to know? Work with the reconstructed 1918 virus was conducted at and supported by the CDC, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the National Institute of Health, and the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, AFIP, affectionately known as, and that's actually, if someone wants a little bit of homework, I have not heard of the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology yet. I would almost bet that's probably in Dugway, where they shipped out all that anthrax from. But just a guess, they all provided support for many other aspects of this research. When did the CDC begin research on the 1918 virus? Well, CDC studies of the 1918 influenza virus were begun in 2004 during George Bush's reign, with the initial testing of viruses containing subsets of the 8 genes of the 1918 virus. Previous articles describing the properties of such virus were published before 2005. Reconstruction of the entire 1918 virus was begun in August of 2005. Oh, well, could a 1918-like H1N1 virus reemerge and cause a panic again? Now, hey, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't one of our quote-unquote, oh my God, it's a national emergency a couple years ago, viruses in H1N1? Isn't that like a bird flu? I'm almost thinking that it might be H1N1. I am pretty sure that that was something that they were going all apeshit over back just a few years ago. I don't know. We'll look at that one too. Okay, could a 1918 like H1N1 virus reemerge and cause a pandemic again? Says the question. The answer? It is impossible to predict with certainty. But the probability of a 1918 virus reemerging from a natural source appears to be remote. Oh, well, good to know. Maybe not from a lab. Influenza experts believe that a pandemic is most likely to be caused by an influenza subtype to which there is little or no pre-existing immunity in the human population. There is evidence that some residual immunity to the 1918 virus or similar is present in at least a portion of the human populace. And yes, when we started learning about the epigenome and the microbiome and all of these different systems that are at work within our body, it's very possible that if your ancestors maybe came down with the 1918 flu and survived, let's say, that you may have some of that, what's the word I'm looking for? Immunity already built into your genes and your immune system, which, you know, oh, I put myself in their evil mindset. I mean, is that what that swine flu, bird flu, never before seen mixture was back a few years ago that we had to declare that state of emergency and let all those vaccines with squalene in to be fast tracked by the FDA? Just to see how quickly it would spread and how many people got sick and how virulent it would be. I remember at the time we'd questioned that whole pandemic. I don't know. Just saying, suspicious. It smells like dog shit to me. All right. Anyway, it says that there's very possible that there is residual immunity within some of the population. And since the contemporary H1N1 viruses circulate widely, and after the current annual influenza vaccines contained H1N1 components, the 1918-like H1N1 virus would not fit the current criteria for a new pandemic strain. Well, and thank goodness, because Tamiflu seems to be effective against the current 1918 flu virus. And it's also shown to be effective against similar viruses to the 1918 virus. Are there any new prophylactics or therapeutics against the 1918 virus underway? Says the reconstruction of the 1918 virus will enable the CDC to pursue development of a vaccine candidate, of course, that would provide optimal protection against this or any similar virus. All right, this goes on for a very long time, and I don't know if I want to read too much more, but I would like to read about the biosafety precautions and their biosafety levels here. Biosafety precautions, is the public at risk from experiments being done on this virus? I mean, can you even believe this is on the CDC's website? And the answer, the work described in this report was done using stringent biosafety and biosecurity precautions. Yes, just like they did for the anthrax, that are designed to protect workers and the public from possible exposure to this virus. It says, what biosafety and biosecurity precautions for protecting laboratory workers and the public were in place while this work was being done? Well, the answer, before the experiments were begun, two tiers of internal CDC approval were conducted, an institutional biosafety committee review, and an animal care and use committee review. All viruses containing one or more gene segments from the 1918 influenza virus were generated and handled in accordance with the biosafety guidelines of the interim CDC National Institute of Health recommendation for raising the biosafety level laboratory work involving non-contemporary human influenza virus. Although the 1918 virus was not designated as a select agent at the time this work was performed, all procedures were carried out using the heightened biosecurity elements mandated by the CDC's select agent program. The Intragovernmental Select Agents and Toxins Technical Advisory Committee, Jesus, recommended that the reconstructed 1918 influenza virus be added to the list of Health and Human Services Select Agents on September 30th, 2005. And following this recommendation, the CDC amended its regulation and designated all reconstructed replication competent forms of the 1918 pandemic influenza virus containing any portion of the coding of any of the eight gene segments as a select agent. Okay, so where is it now? Is it sitting in a filing cabinet in somebody's back room? Well, we have biosafety level three or animal biosafety level three practices, procedures, and facilities, plus enhancements that include special procedures and that are recommended to be working with this 1918 strain. There are four biosafety levels that correspond to the degree of risk by research and involved graded levels for protection. Biosafety level four provides the most stringent containment conditions. Biosafety level one, the least stringent. Why did they only mark this bio level three when this killed upwards of 50 million people? And they reconstructed it. Wow, I just can't get over how posthumous these people think they are. They sit there and they think they are gods. And it's very, very, very concerning. What is biosafety level three enhanced? Oh, that includes specific enhancements, safety cabinets, isolation chambers, gowns and gloves, and a secondary with facility construction and HEPA filtration of exhaust air, the barrier. To protect laboratory workers and the public from accidental exposure. They probably have like that ante room that's sealed, hermetically sealed. I don't know. This goes on and on and on and on and on. Does the report provide a blueprint for bioterrorists to develop and unleash a devastating pandemic on the world? I remember at the time in 2006, that was a big concern. And it says no. This report does not provide a blueprint for the bioterrorists to develop a pandemic influenza strain. The reverse genetic system that was used to generate the 1918 virus is a widely used laboratory technique. While there are concerns that this approach could potentially be misused for the purposes of bioterrorism, there are also clear and significant potential benefits for sharing this information with the scientific community, namely facilitating the development of effective interventions and thereby strengthening public health and national security. Well, yes, isn't that what we learned? Became the new biowarfare program. Instead of being on the offensive and developing bioweapons, the end of 1969 into 1970 to 72, I believe, when Richard Nixon declared the biowarfare program over, he also declared that we were going to spend our time, effort, and money into putting ourselves in a defensive posture and creating vaccines against the biowarfare agents. So, of course, that is a good reason to put this information out there. And what I think is really interesting about their answer to whether or not this could be used as a blueprint for bioterrorists is when they took the bird flu and they let it get out there, it was gene sequenced. And then they didn't publish one report, but they published two reports in the scientific community on how to make it more virulent. So it killed, like, I don't even remember, 90% of the people that infected. Sure, we're going to put it out there to the scientific community. So you know what? They can create more vaccines to keep you safe. All right, let's get back to the rest of that Billy Gates interview. We'll go back now that we have a little bit of history. He talks about the 1918 flu. Notice how he doesn't mention that the CDC recreated it back in 2005. Hold on, I'm gonna back up a little bit more. I think it's right about here. All right, here we go. Oh, wait, I gotta reconnect again. Hopefully. There we go. All right, hold on one second. Here we go.
We looked at the 20th century and we looked at the death chart of the 20th century. I think everybody would say, oh yeah, there must be a spike for World War I. You know, sure enough, there it is, like 25 million. And there must be a big spike for World War II, and there it is, it's like 65 million. But then you'll see this other spike that is as large as World War II, right after World War I, and most people, a lot of people would say, well, what? What was that? There's two kinds of flus. There's flus that spread between humans very effectively, and there's flus that kill lots of people. And those two properties have only been combined into a widespread flu once in history. Well, that is Spanish flu. We have no idea where it came from. It's called the Spanish flu because the Spanish press was the freest. They were the first to talk openly about it. And so in the annals of epidemic history, that's the big event. I funded a disease modeling group that uses computer simulation, and that work has been phenomenal in helping us target our polio eradication resources and, you know, which parts of Nigeria should we work harder on.
I just, when I heard that yesterday, I laughed too. He funded this computer simulation to show what areas of the world they could have the most bang for the buck to make sure that they not only infect but vaccinate all these Nigerian countries, Afghanistan, Pakistan. Oh, goodness, polio outbreak. Now we must force vaccinate. I remember there were reports in Africa about the forced vaccination at gunpoint.
And it's very natural if you have a group like that to say, hey, look at something like the Spanish flu in the modern day. Health systems are far better. And so you think, hey, that wouldn't be very bad. Well, we tried it. And there are some assumptions we had to make. But what we showed is that the force of infection because of modern transport, which compared to 1918 is over 50 times as great. And so if you get something like the flu and you look at that map of how within days, it's basically in all urban centers of the entire globe, that is very eye-opening. That
as he's rubbing his hands together going, oh, as it spread in every urban center in days. Actually, in the one story that I was reading yesterday about the 1918 flu, it was accused of Germany that they had sent an agent, some sort of secret agent to a facility in Maryland. It was some sort of military barracks in Maryland. And that is apparently where they have proposed that the 1918 flu actually kicked off, was there. You know, don't hold me to that. I really would like to dig in more deeply into some of the documentation that I found. But if anyone's interested, if you go to yesterday's show on YouTube for Before the First Cup and go down in the notes in the bottom, you'll see down toward the bottom, I have three links on the 1918 flu, and you can actually follow what I was looking at yesterday.
Didn't happen with Spanish flu in the past. The opportunity to do more than just let it run its course is really only in the last decade. Basically, when you talk about drugs, you can talk about small molecules or talk about these complex biological protein-like things, of which there's a subclass called antibodies. Antibodies are the molecules that the immune system naturally builds to attack disease. Today, the idea that somebody says, oh, here's an antibody, make a lot of it, make it very quickly, that's right on the cutting edge. And the Ebola epidemic showed me that we're not ready for a serious epidemic, an epidemic that would be more infectious and would spread faster than Ebola did.
Ding, 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 ding. Yes, way faster than Ebola.
This is the greatest risk of a huge tragedy. This is the most likely thing by far to kill over 10 million excess people in a year. We don't need to invest nearly what we do in military preparedness. This is something where less than $1 billion a year on R&D, medical surveillance, standby personnel, cross-training the military so they can play a role in terms of...
I just can't even believe that he's bringing the military into... helping prepare for a pandemic. And remember, too, during that Ebola pandemic, I did a story actually on Antimedia about that. We designated and created some new military, like, pandemic team that they were sending out to go, and I don't know if they even, maybe once they used it on U.S. soil, but there was like this military group that was going to be like the hit team to go out when there was some sort of virulence and have them go out and nip it in the bud, hold you down and stick the needle in your arm.
All the logistics are, this can be done, and we may not get many more warnings like this one to say, okay, it's a pretty modest investment to avoid something that really, in terms of the human condition, would be a gigantic setback.
Yes.
A gigantic setback. Oh. Sorry we had to, like, waste a whole half hour listening to Billy Gates, but I really wanted to kind of set the stage because that was where the show ended yesterday. Let's see. If we go here... I just wanted to look because there were a couple things that happened in that time period, too. There was the Blue Angel program that I'm trying to remember. I mentioned it the other day when I had April on the show. George Bush had a whole program that he put out, and there was a very official name and a document for it for combating pandemics. And you know what? I don't think I'm going to remember it. Still too early, and I'm only on like a quarter cup of coffee, but maybe we'll hit that tomorrow since today is only Tuesday. Thank God. DARPA's Blue Angel. Pentagon prepares millions of vaccines against the global flu of the future. This is out of RT News from 2012. Pentagon's DARPA lab has announced a milestone, but it doesn't involve drones or death missiles. No, just little mini missiles. Scientists at the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency says that they have produced 10 million doses of an influenza vaccine in only 1 month's time. In a press release out of the agency's office this week, this is July of 2012, scientists with DARPA said they've reached an important step in being able to combat a flu pandemic that might someday decimate the Earth's population. By working with Medigecko, and they are the company with the tobacco, Medigecko Inc., a vaccine company, the Pentagon's cutting-edge research lab says that they've used a massive harvest of tobacco plants to help produce a plethora of flu-fighting vaccines. Testing confirmed in a single dose of the H1N1 VLP vaccine. Oh, what did we learn that VLPs were? They used VLPs in the Gardasil vaccine. VLPs are virus-like particles. Ding, ding, ding. Good old nanotechnology and synthetic biology at work. Testing confirmed that a single dose of the H1N1 VLP influenza vaccine candidate introduced protective levels of hemagglutinin antibodies in animal models when combined with a standard aluminum adjuvant, the agency writes, while still noting, though, that the equivalent dose required to protect humans from a natural disease can only be determined by future prospective clinical trials. But hey, wait, we need to have a pandemic for that to happen so we can fast track it through the FDA. Researchers had before relied on using chicken eggs to harvest compounds to use in an influenza vaccine, and with a future outbreak requiring scientists to step up with a solution as soon as possible, they've turned to tobacco plants to help produce the vaccine. The World Health Organization has gone on record to say that as much as half of the people on planet Earth, as much as half the people on planet Earth, I mean, literally, I am sure that they were all salivating off their fangs, could be affected by a pandemic in the near future. And it could take as much as 9 months of it raging across planet Earth for a vaccine for a pandemic virus strain to be made available to the public. And with lives of billions and billions of people in the world at stake, DARPA has been trying to do the right thing. That's just my words. To determine new ways of churning out antidotes in as little time as possible. Now its researchers say that only in 1 month, scientists produce more than 10 million doses as defined in an annual animal model of an H1N1 influenza vaccine candidate based on virus-like particles. Though DARPA's previously established Blue Angel program, DARPA's previously established Blue Angel program, researchers have spent several years searching for new ways to produce mass quantities of the vaccine-grade protein that could be used to combat what they say are very real, emerging, and novel biological threats. And if I'm not mistaken, they did this in conjunction with Texas A&M, and they were working also with a facility in North Carolina. And I thought in one of these companies using the tobacco, Philip Morris had bought one of these, was in at least more than half ownership of one of these virus research organizations. And it may have been Medigeco. We did a whole show on them back when we were looking at some of the Ebola stuff and the virus-like particles. But how interesting, you know, a good way to turn the big tobacco ship that was sinking around and make them party to creating vaccines. All right, before we lose all of our time here, I want to get to this other update that we had yesterday about the anthrax. And that's why we took a look at the pandemic 1918 flu, was because, you know, they can re-engineer this stuff in a lab pretty easily. And the fact that they're saying, well, don't worry about it, as we're making this stuff that can kill up to 50 million people and hit all city centers in a very short period of time. Don't worry about it, because we have high security. We have all these provisions in place, and it'll never get out, ever. Unless... yes, Pentagon shipped live anthrax samples also to Canada. Reports says the scandal now involves anthrax sent to labs in 12 states, not 9, Washington, D.C., and 3 countries, including South Korea, Australia, and Canada. Every day, this is getting just a little bit bigger. New, this is from 4 o'clock this morning. New disclosures from Pentagon officials say live samples of anthrax were sent to 3 Canadian laboratories. The scandal now involves anthrax sent to labs in 12 states. And I think yesterday one of the stories I read is it was 28 labs within the United States. 12 states, Washington, D.C., and 3 countries, Australia, Canada, and South Korea. An unnamed Pentagon official not authorized to speak publicly told USA Today that so far, no one that they know of has been sickened by the shipments. But remember, when we went back 3 years ago and watched a CDC video on anthrax, it's anywhere from like 2 to 42 days before you show symptoms. And by the time you show symptoms, it's usually too late for treatment. And when you don't have treatment, the death rate is about 85%. So far, no one has been sickened by the shipments, and the military investigators are continuing to search anthrax samples and records to discover whether further samples were shipped to other labs. The Pentagon admitted last Wednesday that live anthrax was inadvertently shipped from a military lab in Utah across state lines and out of the country over a 1-year period. And like I said, if they've been using radiation to kill it for at least the last year, I'm assuming that they've been doing that for as long as they've been messing around with anthrax. So how many shipments went out before March of 2014? They've been investigating samples that were inadvertently shipped out from a military lab in Utah across state lines and out of the country for a 1-year period that began March 2014 through April 2015. And the research samples were mistakenly marked inactive, according to officials. Now, this is not, we read another story that had talked about, well, they thought it had been dead. And all this time, that's the process they were using. And now they discovered that, no, it doesn't kill them all. So love the way they spun this, that were mistakenly marked inactive. Yes. Not that we had a mistaken procedure that we thought all this time killed all the anthrax and oops, it didn't. The agency said that the public was not at risk from any of the anthrax spores, yet we watched a CDC video again from 3 years ago that said just a few spores spread aerially over a populace could infect up to 100,000 people at a time who wouldn't show symptoms right away. The agency said that the public was not at risk from the anthrax spores, which if inhaled can spark a high fever and other flu-like symptoms and even be lethal. With treatment, the samples, which the military said were shipped commercially, oh yes, on FedEx, no less. Notice this one doesn't mention that either. Were for use in determining whether a new detection test for anthrax and other organisms worked as expected. And notice this, a Maryland lab, ding, 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 first notified the Department of Defense about the live spores after receiving one of the shipments. So far, 28 labs in 12 states and the District of Columbia have received samples, the Center of Disease Control and Prevention said, and the CDC bioterror lab regulators and the Pentagon are investigating why the military lab hadn't thoroughly killed the anthrax specimens before shipping. An email sent to a CDC official said that the methods used to kill anthrax spores are not always fully effective. Now, remember, too, when we first talked about the story last week, we had gone back a year to last July where the CDC had done the very same thing, had shipped out anthrax shipments and then discovered they weren't dead. Oops. Again, like I say, really makes you wonder, as we discover that we have a whole strategic national stockpile of anthrax vaccines sitting there unused, and we have ISIS running around untethered, threatening to attack the homeland, and now we have all these samples of killer fucking anthrax, not only at 28 lab locations all over the United States, but also in three big countries. Makes you wonder, doesn't it? Like I said, just saying, but I'm just saying, this is making all my alarms go off. Boop, boop, boop. And remember, too, there were a few different laws passed, one for quarantine last summer, and also an update as to antibiotic-resistant pathogens that are out there. I mean, they've lined a lot of things up. And then of course, the Ebola strike team to get the military involved in a pandemic and lock things down. Says, quote, "We have concern that the inactivation procedures, when followed properly, are inadequate to kill all the spores. And the U.S. government is developing an approach to securing such possible samples from misuse," wrote Daniel Sosin, deputy director of the CDC's Official of the Public Health Preparedness and Response, in an email to state officials that was obtained by USA Today. So this guy basically said what I've been saying. We have concern that the inactivation procedures, even when followed properly, are inadequate to kill all spores. And the U.S. government is developing an approach to secure all possible samples from misuse. Ding, ding, bioterror. Like again, like I said, every day I've been reading a story and the number gets bigger and bigger. And think about how many samples are out there if this goes from before 2014. Anthrax is known to be one of the most difficult microorganisms to kill, and the bacteria can survive in the form of tough spores for years. The Army facility zaps the anthrax with radiation, which is supposed to render the spores permanently inert, but errors can still occur. Well, look it, if you had something that was that virulent, that could last for years in the environment, and it was known to have tough spores, then why wouldn't you double, triple, and quadruple check those samples after you zapped them to make sure it was all dead before you sent it all over the globe? But don't worry. They have it all under control with their processes and procedures and committees and their level 3 and 4 bioterror facilities to make sure they keep you safe. Quote, one of the things that can happen is that they set it up and they do it, and then they find out later that it only kills 99.99%, says Paul Keem, a biologist at the Northern Arizona University who studies anthrax, in an interview he did with Minnesota Public Radio. That's more than enough if you're killing 100 spores, he says. But if you're doing it to 10 billion spores, he says, you're going to have some that escape. The CDC spokesman, Jason McDonald, said that 4 workers in 3 states are being treated right now for possible anthrax exposure. Separately, the military said that 22 individuals at Osan Air Base in South Korea are also receiving treatment. And I just saw a story yesterday that South Korea is really pissed that we sent a pathogen with that amount of virulence to their country that was potentially still active, and now they have some cases of MERS that have cropped up. Remember, MERS was that upper respiratory that they were seeing in the Middle East, and they are now accusing the United States of potentially being responsible for the MERS, saying, well, did you send that as well as an inactive pathogen to your military lab in our country without telling us? And I don't blame them. I'd be pretty damn pissed. And if not to add insult to injury, you know, for all this time that this war on terror has been going on and we've been told, coerced, and led to believe that they're keeping us safe and that's why we should give up all of our liberties, let's take a look at the TSA. As you've been asked to strip search, take off your shoes, stand in front of a naked body scanner and have your pictures shared online by slimy perverts who sit in the TSA booths. A report just came out. TSA failure. This is out of ABC News Cleveland yesterday. Investigators are able to smuggle weapons past airport checks in 95% of all tests. 95%! An internal investigation of the Transportation Security Administration revealed security failures at dozens of the nation's busiest airports, where undercover investigators were able to smuggle mock explosives or banned weapons through checkpoints in 95% of all the trials that they did. The series of tests were conducted by Homeland Security red teams who posed as passengers setting out to beat the system. According to officials briefed on the results of a recent Homeland Security Inspector General report, the TSA agents failed 67 out of 70 tests, with red team members repeatedly able to get potential weapons through checkpoints. In one test, an undercover agent was stopped after setting off an alarm at a magnetometer, but TSA screeners failed to detect a fake explosive device that was taped to his back during a follow-up pat-down. Jeez. Officials would not divulge the exact time period of the testing other than to say it was concluded recently. And the scary thing about this is, so are they going to take now all their failures and their complete inability to do, I mean, they blow all this money, this taxpayer money, and they failed miserably, yet they all got rich, and we all lost our liberties. Just like the NSA taking all the phone calls. I mean, we lost all of our liberties, but did they really catch any terrorists? I mean, this is happening over and over and over. It's the mantra. So is this going to be the drop in the bucket for them to make it even more strict? You know what? Get naked now if you want to get on a plane. Body cavity searches for everybody. And let's have paramilitary gear doing invasive searches on everybody. Oh, let's do some sort of mad science gone mad using robotics and scanning you with lasers from 30 meters in every orifice, nook, and cranny. Here, I'm going to play this last video in the last minute and a half we have left. Here's something to be aware of. After that scandal, the acting TSA chief just resigned because of his failures. Oh, looky, looky. Come on, damn it. Well, we might not be able to talk about this because nothing works now. I must have mentioned, DNS probe. We cannot connect to the internet. All right, hold on. Maybe I can play the clock. Maybe I can play the clock. And let's see. Come on, damn it. Hold on. Hang up. And I don't think I'm going to be able to make it. Oh, I hate this. This happens every single fucking day. And no. Oh, well. You know what? I'm not going to get stressed like I did yesterday because it really pissed me off to the point where I had to just stop working yesterday afternoon because everything broke everywhere. Oh. There's also some mysterious FBI surveillance aircraft that's been cruising around. But guess what? We can't play that one either. So I really don't care. Here's one more. Be careful with your face at airports. Oh, but guess what? That doesn't load either, and that's just a story. So, hey, guess what? We're going to kick this one off early, and I'm just going to blab for a minute and a half because now nothing goes anywhere. I got 30 seconds. Make sure you guys stick around because it's actually Tuesday, not Wednesday, which is a really good thing. We have Kevin Blanche up next. Tonight we have Chuck live at 6 p.m. Eastern against the wall with JJ. Not sure if JJ is going to be live or it's going to be against the wall recall, but we will see. Primer time live at 9 with Michael and Nick. 10 o'clock Geoengineering Watch live with Dane. And at 11 p.m. Eastern, Anti-Media with SM Gibson. All right, guys. Everyone have an awesome Tuesday.